This is Present at the Creation, a conversation on the origins of slam poetry in Chicago and on some of slam's historical consequences. Speakers are Luis Rodriguez, Sharon Mesmer, Paul McComas, and Kurt Heinz. The conversation was organized and emceed by Tim W. Brown for the AWP conference and convened in the late afternoon of 3 March 2012 in Chicago. All featured speakers were active writers and performers, and often publishers too, during the years of slam poetry's genesis. A caution to younger or more sensitive listeners, this conversation is not censored.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out to this event. I think it's a very seminal event, and I'm very sorry that we don't have more people here to witness it, because we have, like, certainly big participants from this particular part of history in Chicago letters. I just thought we'd kind of be fairly free-form here. And however, I'll kind of introduce everybody at first. And if you could just tell us about yourselves in, you know, brief terms, and then we'll get to the meat of the matter. Just starting out, I'm Tim W. Brown. I'll be your pilot. I mean, excuse me, your moderator for this event.
Wait a second. Our audience is about to improve by 50%.
Please join us, won't you?
Come on in.
You have the chance to double our size simply by entering.
There's drugs and liquor in here. And free food.
We actually scared them away.
I know, yeah. I know.
They were coming in. We scared them
I know.
Away.
Drugs,
you don't deserve to be here.
There's people now.
Oh, that's right.
All right. Well, anyway.
You can't handle the truth.
Chicago, crazy Chicago poets. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
My particular time spent during the 1980s was in publishing a poetry zine called Tomorrow Magazine, as well as an aspiring writer.
Woo!
Pretty much everybody... I don't know if Luis was ever published in it, but I think everybody else on this panel was at one point.
I'll say I was.
Sure, I mean.
And most audience members were, too.
Sure.
Thank you for remembering us with
Jessica was a fetus, but she was in the magazine.
Yes. Anyway, that's kind of what I did. Since that time, I moved to New York about 8 years ago. Always kind of kept in touch with and observed people in the scene, what they're doing these days. But then I started thinking, well, we should probably commemorate it being 20-some years later. What we were doing back then, I think it was really an important time in American letters that is under-acknowledged and underappreciated, the poetry that went on here. I mean, there's certain aspects of it that people know about and remember, but there's a lot more going on, which I hope we'll cover here. So we'll just head down here. If you just like say a few words about yourself, we'll start with Luis Rodriguez, who did a lot of stuff between then, and he's still doing stuff now.
Thank you. And real briefly, just want to say that I'm the founder of the Atucha Press, who had ended up being very important for the Chicago poetry scene and publishing and getting people on a national level, because I didn't realize that it was going to bring people national attention. And the press is still active. You can get the masses of you can get these little flyers. And the other thing is that I also continue my own poetry and writing. So now I actually have 15 books. Poetry, children's books, fiction, nonfiction. So I've been doing pretty prolific. But the other thing I just want to add, that when I moved back to L.A., I think I told you it was Tim, but it was actually like 12 years ago, I started a cultural space. Really, I think the spirit of Chicago is there. It's a multi-arts, multimedia, cafe, cultural space with a little bookstore. We have a performance space. We have a workshop center. We have an art gallery. It's all mixed in, and I don't think there's any place in L.A. like it. So I think that's one of the things that I feel was very powerful about being part of the Chicago poetry scene, was that it helped me go to L.A. and really just take some of that with me.
That's great. Thanks, Luis. Next to Luis, we have Sharon Mesmer. She's here from that other borough that starts with BR, Brooklyn. She also was very active in the scene, and she'll tell you more.
Thank you. I was mainly active in the late 70s, early 80s, with Connie Dianovich and Deborah Pintinelli. I started a magazine called Bee City. That was in 1983. Then we left that And we started Letter X with Carl Watson. Mm. And it was around that time, 1984, 1985, that we started hanging out at the Get Me High Lounge, because we all lived in Wicker Park and environs. That was the beginning of the scene at the Get Me High Lounge. And I was ranting, you know, well, when don't I rant? At the beginning, before people started coming in, you know, about the birth of the slam. And I said that people tend to forget that it was Al Simmons who started the slam. It was Al Simmons who started the slam at Tut's on Belmont. And it was Lydia Tomcu, Jerome Sala, Michelle Fitzsimmons. The fourth person. I can't believe I can't think of his name.
I'm having a senior moment now.
I can't think of his name. and I'll think of it. And that was the first. It wasn't called a slam, though. It was called a Poetry Championship Series or something. And then Paul Etchemate took it over at the Get Me High.
He was a rock artist, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah. He was a local rock star.
Yeah.
Jim something.
We'll get to it.
Yeah, Jim something. God, I can't believe I can't remember it. And Mark Smith was hanging around. Mark Smith and Ron Gillette were hanging around at the Get Me High, and then it got translated into the slam. And then it went on to the Green Mill. So, and then the issue about people not publishing, that's something I also wanted to talk about. But that's my story. And now I live in Brooklyn.
Great, thanks. I live in the Bronx. That's the borough that, you know, starts with BR, that competes with hers.
Lovingly.
Anyway, yeah, there's not really much competition, because Brooklyn just eclipses everything. But anyway.
Look at you. Even Manhattan in some ways.
Yeah, eclipses Manhattan.
Oh, Manhattan sucks.
Yeah, I've heard people in Manhattan want to be more like people in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Cheaper would be better.
We don't have that here with, like, Wilmette and Winnetka, you know? It just doesn't have Kenilworth.
Somebody should write that story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, to my left here is another writer from this period of time, a bit more unusual than some of the other people on this panel. He, like I, was more of a fiction writer, and we used to go around town and perform our fiction mixed together with the poets, and they kind of tolerated us because, you know, we kind of caught on and, you know, did kind of what they were doing, just with, you know, longer pieces of writing. Anyway, Paul, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, hi, Paul McComas, and it's interesting to hear myself described as a writer from that past period of time. I started then. Hopefully I'm a writer from this period of time, too. Hopefully we all are. But, some of what I did was poetry, prose poetry. But a lot of it, as Tim said, was more fiction and narrative-based. Although often that took the form of in-character monologues. And what I was doing kind of had a foot in prose poetry, a foot in performance art, a foot in fiction, a foot in live theater, a tentacle in something else. It was very willfully uncategorizable. The nice thing about the scene was that for the most part, and particularly early on, they weren't looking to categorize you necessarily. The fact that you were expansive in your approach was seen by most people most of the time as a good thing. And no, I wasn't really published back then outside of a few pieces in literary mags, but I've put out 4 books since then. One thing I'd like to do at some point, maybe later in this panel, is just read off the names of a bunch of the places where we all used to do our thing. I keep a pretty good filing system, and I went through it earlier today and pulled out all the old flyers and leaflets and promo cards and managed to come up with, if not the comprehensive list, then a good start at it. There were a lot of places to do it in Chicago, which was wonderful. And one of the neat things was you'd get referrals. If people liked you at Sheffield's, they'd say, hey, you should let me put you in touch with Millie Zorka's show, and so on and so forth. So it was very easy once you started to get out there pretty far and wide.
Yeah, I think it's
Jim Desmond.
Yes, there you go. I was going to say Jimmy Desmond if you didn't, yeah.
Jim Desmond.
It's going to drive you crazy. Wow.
He used to do films with people down here at Columbia College, too.
Yes,
so
he did.
Yeah,
he did.
So it was interdisciplinary even then.
By the way, let the record show that our audience population has now reached that that magical moment where there are as many people out there as there are in the panel. So anything after this is just, you know, frosting on the cake. Thank you all for coming.
Last and then not least, however, is at the end there is Kurt Hines. Kurt is like a documentarian extraordinaire. He's documented a lot of the scene in the 80s and 90s and presumably maybe up to the present day. Although
up to this present second if you're talking through my microphone.
Yeah, in fact, I hope the crowd noise does not drown us out.
Oh, I don't. I think we're safe there. Yeah.
And he'll tell us a little bit more.
Thank you. I'm really proud to be here. I don't care if it's only as few people as we are. I think there's a lot of stuff that's good about this, getting it to out for the record. I am still writing. I do write poetry, and I think some of it's rather successful as performance poetry. So I'm still out there slugging away. But I do not consider myself a slammer, and I would be at task with people who did. I do not consider myself an outlaw, per se, but I made the mistake, I think, early on. I got into the situation a little later than Sharon did. I'm probably part of the Butchie's Get Me High class of 1986.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I was not aware until I actually interviewed Jerome Sala and others about that scene over, which was quite a deal because in 1994 a lot of them had moved to
here.
New York.
Yeah. Oh, wait, where am I? Chicago.
Yeah, New York. And so I had long distance phone bills up the wazoo. And I published that as a paper for some friends I was in 94 called The Incomplete History of Slam, which I believe was the first written documentation about slam as a movement ever. And it came out shortly thereafter as a website, which I've maintained ever. My mistake with them was not that I came from a background where performance art and experimental film were givens, that I talked about it. I didn't feel that experience was welcome. There were a lot of us who were crossing over. A lot of the people I noticed in early slam days in the late 80s, early 90s, I had seen in performance art venues around Chicago frequently. In fact, some of the core members of the Chicago Poetry Ensemble were like that. But it was not exactly a closeted secret, but it was not something that really had a place in the conversation about slam at the time. I remained a closet case, as it were, regarding my performance art interests. I like performance art and performance poetry both about as much. But in time, I began to regard both disciplines as sort of like Army versus Navy. The people in both tribes didn't really get along. And from the picture I got, it was more the slammers saying to hell with the performance artists than the other way around. But that's a subject for a long conversation right there.
Mm. Yeah, I've been discussing that with my psychiatrist week in and week out for years. Anyway, all right. Well,
less filling
so
tastes great kind of issues, yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for telling us a little bit more about yourselves. We'll get into the meat of the things, I hope. Just want to throw a couple of observations and or questions out there. What made spoken word interests and influences converge in Chicago at this particular time?
Punk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Punk.
There's a huge overlap with the punk rock
movement. Punk and the art movement.
And just the whole DIY aesthetic.
Yeah. And there was also, I mean, I hate to keep bringing in New York, but I mean, I remember when Karen Finley performed in Chicago. She was a huge influence.
At Tony Fitzpatrick's place,
Tony Fitzpatrick.
Edge of the Looking Glass in the South Loop.
Right. And there was a lot of stuff.
Talk about slam crossover there.
Yeah, there was a lot of, it was just a performative aspect. But I think punk had a lot to do with it. It was the end of the punk, you know, era, basically. But there was a lot, you know, O'Banion's and Lemaire, a lot of those people went over to other artistic venues and did things.
A mutation process, basically.
Yeah.
I didn't get into the punk thing. I caught up with Lemaire Vipere after the fact again.
Yeah.
I got into Chicago myself about 83, and by that time a lot of the punk thing had kind of collapsed or faded away. But I still saw it in performance artists who had a monologue tendency. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Linda Montano at High Performance wrote about this distinctly. I remember reading it. that Chicago performance artists in particular had a strange disposition for just wanting to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And their storytelling was there. Now, this is not out in the saloons or in the neighborhoods kind of stuff. This is still happening at places like Club Lower Links, Randolph Street Gallery and the like.
Sure.
But I kept finding people at Randolph, for example, who might later run into at Slam Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is for me evidence of a really strong crossover. It's just not a question of whether it's talked about in the current literature or from the current pontification.
I also think it was important that we weren't New York and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Because I think I came out of L.A. and I was part of some of the performance stuff. That's the early, late 70s, early 80s. And they were all geared to the industry. You know what I'm saying? The beautiful thing about Chicago is people weren't geared to the industry. They were just telling stories. They were just getting up. They were just creating a scene. They were creating something. It wasn't geared towards the movies or the bar Broadway. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't geared to any of the big coasts. So I think this is what added a lot of energy to Chicago, my feeling, that it was just wasn't being drawn out in these other areas. It was coming out of the...
And that goes hand-in-hand with what Sharon was saying about punk. You know, again, not for any particular industry or corporate model or market niche, but simply because these things were needed to be expressed.
I think to Luis's point that, I mean, my comments earlier could have come off as a little high hat, like, oh, yes, fine art empowered the slam movement. No.
No.
There were people spilling out of it, but there were people spilling out of that punk, and as Luis indicates, just common folk who were coming in because they were piqued by this. And folks felt that they could say something. There was a certain... Well, what was I watching? I was watching a TED lecture about a guy talking about why YouTube is so important. There was, like, surprise in it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a participation in it. And there's one other thing which doesn't come to mind right now, but it doesn't
probably
matter.
Started with the
possibility.
Possibility.
Yeah, you could do... Also, like, all these people were talking about it, and I'm thinking about even a group like... I don't know if anybody remembers them. Somebody's Daughters.
Yes.
Three women. All they would do is jump around on trampolines, and you know, but they had an aesthetic. Everybody had a thing that they did. And it was like, this is what we do. We're going to find a place to do it. You know, it was just very individual. It was very crafted from coming from the personality. It was not academic. It was not corporate. It was not industry-based at all. You didn't have to have a degree. You didn't have to have money, for one thing. You could do all this stuff with...
It was okay to experiment. And the other thing, Anna Brown, who was in some of these dogs, the key performer with that, she was one of the very first two people who ever slammed under the title Slam.
That's right.
When it was a rigged gig between her and Gene Howard at the at the Green Mill Lounge, I think 1986.
Right.
And this is just how it went down. You know, they both got up in... These two women got up in boxing or sort of professional wrestling getup.
Right.
And did this thing where they're sort of slugging it out, but recalling poetry in the duel instead of hitting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then people had to score. That was a slam. It was an entertainment. Mm-hmm. It was not an official competition. And it's, in some ways, I think, it echoes your notion of what Jimmy Desmond and everybody was doing back at the punk clubs years before.
But this is why even the punk movement here was different than the coast, but also the theater movement in Chicago was so different. It was amateur.
We can slam here, but not get that hurt.
He has a point about amateurs. We were coming out of the amateur world creating stuff, not a professional world. Because, I have to go back to L.A., people had... You were professional, and people were looking at, are you really going to be an actor? And they didn't care about the small guy and the small woman. I mean, small, but, you know, coming from the community. They didn't care about that. You had to hear. People didn't care that you were from any of that.
I know.
You also heard terms like working class and blue collar being thrown around a lot.
And that was important. I think this was something that was important because in Chicago, I don't know, I haven't lived here in 25 years. There was always this thing, you know, like... You do it yourself. You know what I mean? It was like, you just do it. You know, you don't give a shit who, you know, it was like this kind of like working class
don't hold
chip
back,
on
Sharon.
Your shoulder, kind of like, fuck you, you don't like it, I'm doing it anyway. Yeah. I'm going to find a place and I'm going to do it. Yeah. And
punk
that
integrity.
Was it. You know, it was like, I'm going to find my way. I am not affiliated with a school.
Right,
I'm not an academic. I'm not of this. I'm not of that. This is just me. I'm an artist.
Yeah.
You know, the class thing was a positive factor, not something that would hold you back.
And something certainly that Mark Smith drew on
definitely.
Liberally.
It made things very dicey if you stepped outside there, I'll say. Because when I was involved with performance, they're like, so are you at the Circle or the Toot? You know, it's like there are only two schools that ever really engage performance.
The
Art Institute of Chicago, the Toot, or Circle, meaning UIC.
UIC, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, neither. And people would look at me like, geez, what planet are you from?
Right.
And I was like, well,
the real world.
Well,
sucker.
That I was out there. I was out there on the other side of my life, hanging with the slammers.
Planet.
You know, so
that
was how I could kind of appease this. You know, say, all right, enough with the snobbery of the performance artists. I can get with the slammers. It's okay.
Yeah.
But then there was also, if I recall, some snobbery among the slammers.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a reverse snobbery, if you will. I think finish up this point a little bit. I think what Luis said was particularly important. He used the word community.
Mm-hmm.
This truly was a community-based writing movement.
Mm-hmm.
There were people from all walks of life. Working class was particularly welcome. It gave you a certain sense of authenticity that somebody from a university writer, creative program would not have. And I think the economics of Chicago at that time, and even still today, compared to places like New York or L.A. or San Francisco, real estate is cheaper here.
Yeah.
And so there were venues like bars and clubs and lounges and performance spaces that were able to make something of a go of it because rents were so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were in these fringe neighborhoods, but they drew people nonetheless.
Tim, may I read my partial list of those now?
Sure.
Seems like a good segue. Yeah. And a couple have already been mentioned, but... there was, of course, the Uptown Poetry Slam at the Green Mill, was and is. Name Gallery.
Oh, God, yeah.
Both on Carpenter and then later up on Wabash. Randall Street Gallery. Lynx Hall and Lower Lynx, not the same thing.
Right.
Cafe Voltaire, Batteries Not Included. Mm-hmm. Sheffield's, The Roxy, mm-hmm. The Vic, Get Me High.
Mm-hmm.
Lounge Acts, which is where Millie's Orchid Show started. When I did Millie's, they were at Lounge Acts.
Park West is a recent advent.
Park West is recent. Twilight Tales at the Red Lion, The Blue Room at Mirador, Atelier Sub Rosa, remember them, at Zebra Crossing?
Well,
Mama Java's Coffee House in Evanstown, A Stage of One's Own Theater, Greenview Gallery, Ontario Art Space, and I know I've left a lot out.
Artful Dodger
was one.
When
the Bob Phyllis's
musical
in.
Phyllis's, right.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's like a load, a little, and these are not highbrow joints, a lot of them. They're not supposed to be.
I loved it too.
You know, it was where you could just go hang, meet friends, have a beer or something better, and go on.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things I just to wrap up this point that I found remarkable in regards to the community aspect of the scene, it was extremely integrated. Racially and ethnically.
I was going to add
and
that.
Orientationally.
And I'm going to tell you something because, again, I came into the scene in 85, and it just started. It was just starting. I came in, I didn't plan it. I didn't know. By 88, I was getting myself known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of the things that drew me is that people didn't care what community you were from. You had a voice. You had a story. You mm-hmm. were going
to
be heard.
You had to be good.
Because in LA, again, coming from LA, it was segregated. There were certain people. They had nights for Mexicans and nights for African Americans. I go, what can answer that?
Mm.
But in Chicago, every night, anybody who happened to walk in the door who had something could had a chance mm-hmm. to read. So to me, that was very, very compelling that there was people open
it's
to
a,
hearing
it. It's a difficult ecology to maintain. I've seen it drift in and out of different venues, many who've come and gone here in Paul's short list. I have had to find that. I still find the America I wanted, not the one I got,
right.
At Metal Graffiti. Because they're, like you were saying, Paul, that they're not just ethnically mixed, they're gender mixed. They're sort of, there's still sort of a generational thing going on, though. Now, that seems to be strengthening over time. I remember at Metal Graffiti, though, I could introduce somebody like Mitch Watiki, who passed away. He was a senior. He was like 60, 70 years old in the day then. And he would get serious respect, mm-hmm. you know, versus now it's kind of like hard to find mature writers in these cases unless they're brought in, not necessarily as a curio, but look at who we found. Mm-hmm. You should hear this person kind. And it's like, I don't want to be treated like a token,
yeah.
you know, yeah. on my generation or based on my experience. I want to be appreciated for what the work is.
Well, there's also, remember David Hernandez?
That's what
yeah.
I say.
David Hernandez was an, I don't know, not an older man.
I don't have to speak. You're just, you do it.
But
doing it.
We were at the same time. But well, I mean, it was like he was an older person. He was in his 40s, and he had a band.
And he was, and to listen to David Hernandez, and people loved it.
He was great.
And then, of course, people like Michael Ward and Patricia Smith could come into it, and people would love them. Everybody came out of this community. It was all about that. Now, I'm not trying to say there wasn't racist moments.
Yeah.
There weren't some hard moments. But overall, it really wasn't about that. I'm being honest with you. People were
you know,
just
you're
open.
Right, and it never occurred to me that it could be otherwise. But to hear you describe how, for instance, it was in L.A., I mean, you would never go to Lower Links or the Roxy or any of these other places we talk about and find that this was their special night set aside for a certain type of person.
Right.
You know, it's really amazing.
I can't imagine that.
Right.
Well, I can tell you, you know, the divisions, segregation, if you will, amongst writing communities. I see it in New York City. I was very surprised when I moved there to find that the scene was extremely segregated. I would go to events, you know, poetry readings, much like what we used to have or still have here, and I'd look around like, geez, where are the black people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I later learned that there is a totally different, very vibrant writing scene uptown in the Harlem neighborhood. They have a Harlem Book Fair each year, and they virtually have no contact with the midtown or downtown publishers who are largely white. You know, the Latino community there, they're sort of segregated kind of in the Bronx and a couple pockets in Brooklyn. And it was shocking to me because I didn't see the rainbow of people.
Well, during the slams at the Nuyorican, that was a place where everybody would get together. But I think that was corrupted when it got famous. And then it was like you'd have these like NYU kids come, and you know, I'm not saying anything that they're bad. It's just like they would sit there kind of like, are we supposed to laugh? Are we supposed to applaud? What are we supposed to do? And instead of like having this audience that was like participating and yelling at you and you were yelling at them and it was like heckling and everything, and all of a sudden it was like, I'm supposed to dress up and act a certain way to be here. But in the beginning, it was really a lot of fun.
I wonder if in some ways the fact that we were a smaller market here in Chicago
and nobody cared
helped.
Yeah.
Because
if
we were going to have a scene, it was going to be inclusive.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying that there was a conscious decision made. I think most of us in that scene were, by our nature, pretty inclusive type people who really wanted to be exposed to all kinds of cultures and orientations and traditions and realized that it made for a better stew.
Yeah.
But maybe unconsciously we also realized that, well, we could have some tiny little fragmented, individuated scenes, or we could have a pretty good-sized and diverse scene. And that's what we ended up having.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's another ecology point. I keep coming back to ecology because if I learned anything out of this whole thing, it's like they're creative ecologies. You know, I didn't get introduced to the term formally until about 2002. You had something, a question about that?
I had a comment because you really got me thinking here. And so I'm sort of formulating this as I'm thinking, which is that figuring like the age of a lot of the people participating in the slams and the other performance events that you're talking about, these are people who probably came of age in the Chicago public schools as a
Catholic school.
Before integrated. You know, as I did, going to Chicago public schools in the 60s and the 70s, they were more or less integrated. You know, there was issues there. So that was kind of part of the culture, whereas in New York, it's a very different situation.
What do you mean?
I think a lot of us had public experience, but to the earlier comments about the scene being integrated, I didn't really notice it stratify along public, private, or, you know, class might have been in it a little bit.
Mm.
And I think sometimes people, after they got acquainted with each other, they reacted to it because there was a kind of egalitarianism in it through all the thing. And it remains today. That it's sort of pronounced that slam is an egalitarian movement.
Mm-hmm.
Your name can be dirt if you earn more than, if you're budging up against the last 1%. But I don't see that really happening. I saw it more as
what people are coming out of.
Right. What they're coming out of didn't seem to matter too much because what people were paying attention to was what was happening in the place. there was an informal competition among people. You can talk about slam as a competition where people are ranking by numbers, but then you can go back to even Butchie's Get Me High in the earlier days, before anything at Uptown Poetry Slam, and people were still hedging. I don't know you really well, but we must have crossed paths an awful lot, and I bet you could corroborate this. People would see things on the mic, and they would be like, damn, I could have done that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sure.
And so there would be this weird sense of upping your own ante to keep up with your neighbors. And you didn't really care too much who the neighbors were. You just wanted to be better.
Now there seems to be, well, back then there was a competition to be, I don't want to say to be a good writer, but there was a competition like I could, you know, like, you know, when I was friends, I was still friends with Debbie and Carl.
Mm-hmm.
It was always this thing like they wrote something good, I want to write something good. I wrote something good, they wanted to write something good. Now I think that has been replaced by jobs. I hate to say it, but it's like this person has this job, I need to get this job. This person has this.
That sad because suddenly it's about status instead of being about the work.
Yeah, I think that's. I don't mean to be like, you know,
Saul
Alinsky here, you know. But
also about performance over the work, because I think that what was good about Chicago scene, people were interested in writing.
Yeah.
And Debbie was, she was a good friend. She helped introduce me to people. I wrote for Letter X because she brought me in. And the thing is it was about good writing. She was very adamant about it, and everybody that was around me were about the writing. It wasn't about
being
just
hip.
Yeah. Now I've seen slams where people that there's no foundation in good writing. It is almost all performance. And I've been to other slams, and one time I give an example. I was in I don't even know what city. Somebody I did my reading, and I'm not a slammer. I'm like Kurt. I was around it. I never really was into the slam, but I was around it. But anyway, I'm reading my poetry, and then somebody gets up and they're going to slam with. And like come out in the slam. So what I did, and this is kind of embarrassing for them, is I wrote down everything this person said, and then I got up after and I read back what this person said without the performance.
Oh,
it was
nice.
Very bad. Oh.
Oh man,
I got in trouble. But
that's tough.
Well, you know,
but I was making a point. Listen, we performed. There was art, but we also thought about good writing.
Yeah,
that was important. Yeah.
Still, though, to me, the best people. I was a slam semifinalist, and Tracy Morris beat me. But you know, it's like at the beginning of the slam. No, what I'm going to say is, like, all these people, the best slam people, Paul Beatty, Tracy, Todd Colby, the work was good. Mm-hmm. I mean, the foundation of the work, I mean, you can look at Tracy's or Paul's or Todd's work on the paper, and it's really good. You know what I mean? It's really good. And then when they perform it, they know how to inflect their voices. They have a rhythm. It's like what they used to say about Jimi Hendrix. Like, Jimi Hendrix was not a good singer, but he had great timing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, he didn't have the voice, but he knew how to say shit. And that was a big thing. Now, I mean, his lyrics were great, but I mean, it was like also you knew because you had a backgrounding in literature, you saw performances, you read the Harlem poets, you read Sylvia Plath, you read all these other people, you read the Beats, and you knew what a line break was, and you knew where to put something so that, you know, it would have an impact. And then when you said the next line, you were continuing that or starting something else. It was like acting in a way. It was like you were writing it.
Because so many of these experiences were new to us, among each other even. I don't think anybody really knew what slam was supposed to be.
Right.
And I've often had this spasm where I was thinking, gee, slam meant a lot more to me when I didn't know what it was supposed to be.
Right.
You know, because it had freedom. There were creative prerogatives wide open in front of you.
I think it became a victim of its own success in certain ways.
Yes, I agree with that.
And I say that as someone who, you know, performed at the Green Mill 10 or 12 times over 10 or 12 years, starting in 86 when they began. And I never competed. I wasn't a poet, which is probably the main reason I never competed in the slam. Mark would bring me in to do the second set in between the open mic and the competition, the actual, you know, between the open mic and the slam. And that was great. It was fun. I could do 15 minutes worth of work, sometimes solo, once I did a piece with Paula Killen. Then I would stay and watch the slam. And what I got was a real time-lapse image, because I would show up about once a year
and do my thing and then stay and see the slam. And what I saw over time was that more and more people were playing to the room, playing to the crowd, playing to the expectations, playing to the formula, and it was getting narrower and narrower instead of getting broader and broader. And that's a shame because it was quite broad in the beginning.
This might actually be a good segue into another topic that I wanted to cover in this panel. It's obviously related. Everything we're talking about today is related. But each of us on this panel had something to do with documenting the scene back in the day. Luis, publisher of Tia Chucha Press. Sharon worked at Letter X. I wrote for Letter X sometimes. Paul, video performance. Kurt, certainly video, web, sound, you name it. But there were a lot of people, in my perception, that were not so interested in having this captured in any way that documentation would capture it. Well, they liked being on the videos, but they just didn't want to publish their work. I used to go around with my magazine, Zine Tomorrow, and ask people that were performing around town at some of these places that Paul mentioned, asked them to submit to the magazine, and I would never hear from them again. You know, they just were not, in my impression, interested in publication. The most notorious example I can give of this was Mark Smith, who keeps coming up in our conversations. He didn't publish a book of poetry until the year 2000, 14 years after the Slam was founded. And, you know, I just thought that was appalling. And one of the things I said, actually, in Letter X, I wrote a long article that I don't know who had the clever idea, Sharon, but they put the Hindenburg blowing up image on top of it.
It might have been dead.
I was taking down the Uptown Poetry Slam in this article. And my point was, well, these people like perform poetry. They need to be better readers of poetry. And, you know, they actually should maybe spend some money buying some poetry or at least going to the damn library and reading it. Or sending work in themselves to magazines. There were certainly a number of magazines that would have been open to their work around town. Sharon mentioned Black and White, Bee City, Hammers, Strong Coffee, Tomorrow, obviously. There were a lot of outlets for people. And
Oink
they just
was,
Hyphen
Oink
was in there.
Oh, Oink, right. Oink. Erie Street Press. I remember that from the
interview. Yeah, Lucky Star.
But was Henry's I want to maybe ask people now, tell us a little bit more about like what you did in what your aims were perhaps in documenting the scene in some way, your objectives, maybe some of the people you collaborated with, some of your experiences, good, bad.
Well, let me start with the Tia Chucha Press, because I think the Tia Chucha Press helped change a lot of that. Mm-hmm. For Mark, too, even though I'm sure he's not going to say it, Tony Fitzpatrick republished all of them, Patricia Smith, Lisa Boscani, Gene Howard, David Hernandez. We published everybody that was coming out of the scene. And
I put you guys in Tomorrow at the top of the list in terms of.
And, you know, I think it helped change people. Because here's what happened. When I started the Itch to Press and started with my book, I would sell the book out of my trunk. So I'd go to a poetry scene, you know, and then I would read, and then I would be. And I think that changed a little bit what people were thinking, because people came to me, hey, can you do that for me?
You know, it's interesting, Elise, some of the people whose complete collections you published were people that I invited to submit to Tomorrow and never did.
I know. Mm-hmm. I know. I think Tony Fitzpatrick was one of those guys that didn't want to do it. But we got a book from him. In other words, I think it started to change so people could see the power of it. And then I was publishing the ones that more or less were great with writing to. It wasn't just... You know how many people came to me now, their names will be not mentioned, who I didn't want to publish. They were a part of the scene. Mm-hmm. It just didn't work for me. But I was publishing the ones that I thought, well, they have something on the page, too. It was that battle stage and page, and my thing, why battle it?
Right. You know? Why should they be mutually exclusive?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, how about trying to master both?
You hit a home run with Patricia because she's canonical now.
Yeah.
And one of the lovely things there is that because you'd sort of, Tim, you sort of fielded this question to us by email in advance. My reaction was like, pages. Who says you're not going to publish? One guy might not publish, but you know, thanks to Luis, a lot of people in the heart of it got published and did it willfully.
Yeah. And thanks to you too, Tim. Did it while the fatwa against
publishing was in open effect, and a lot of other people were doing books on their own in different directions. from different. There was a lot of people coming into this who had publishing backgrounds. The one thing that I think we're so fond of thinking is like, oh, we're all so egalitarian, we're all slam poets. Baloney. A lot of us had writing degrees coming into this. A lot of us had been published already coming into it. Maybe not me. Maybe I was an engineer not going to lit school and trying to run slams at the nighttime. But I was trying to treat it on the up and up. Mm. And so I was sort of cowed by this thou shalt not publish thing.
And I have to add something else. I did the first slam poetry tour of Europe. And it was with me, Paul Beatty, Patricia Smith, Dominic Lowe from San Francisco. Alan Kaufman was the guy that was organizing it.
He's in San
Francisco. Neely Tchaikovsky. Yeah, and what happens, here's what we said. It was labeled the first slam poetry tour. We didn't slam. We just felt... let's just read. It's like, okay, that's fine. We just read. But we came out of that scene, obviously. But the point was, we didn't even want to slam. It was just being out there and just reading, performing. Everybody had their poets, their poems, memorized. And it was amazing.
The competitive part of it has always been my least favorite part. Yeah. I love the performance aspect of it. Yeah. It has helped me so much. I'm sure, to a person here, everyone, once your own books started coming out and you were doing author events, Jesus, you'd come up through this scene. And so it was second nature to get up and either have the piece, the excerpt memorized or be almost off book or just be able to really knock it out of the park and leave people fairly agog because they're used to the author who buries his or her nose in the book and mutters a few words sotto voce. So I love the performance aspect of it was huge. Mm-hmm. The competitive aspect of it is a real double-edged sword, and actually I think more harm than good when all is said and done.
When this question first came up, about why no one published, I sent you an email. I totally took issue with this because Debbie and Connie and I started B-City in like 82 or 83. It came out in 84, but we started taking submissions like in 82 and 83. I just felt like we published Anne Waldman in that magazine. We published Andre Codrescu in that magazine. And our reason for doing this was because we were really sick of, I don't know, we just noticed this lethargy. Like, there's so much good stuff here, and everybody is just not like, everybody's not coagulating,
I think lethargy deserves it better than some kind of a fatwa, because I was never aware of a sense of thou shalt not publish.
No, yeah.
I wasn't aware of it. Sending my stuff to literary magazines, I was getting published in like Cream City Review in Milwaukee and in Folio in Washington, D.C., and I look back at it now and I realize, hey, I wasn't, other than Tomorrow, getting published in Chicago because there wasn't much here at the time.
And that was why we started Letter X, because we, in 84, 85, because it was like, then we were really angry. We were like, what is going on here? Why don't you people get up off your asses and do something?
Right.
And so then Debbie, when she graduated from Columbia, got this thing called the Alfred P. Weissman Scholarship. And she did a video called The New Alchemy. And it was interviews with Chicago poets. It was Jerome, Elaine, Carl, myself, and her. And talking about, and I'll never forget Carl saying, and all of us were saying, being a Chicago poet, it's like hitting your head up against a brick wall constantly. It's like, I got this work. I want to get it out. Why can't I do it? So we just fucking did it ourselves.
That was the beauty of the scene, that you were allowed to do that and you succeeded.
No, we didn't need money to do it. It was
didn't
just cheap.
Money, didn't need permission.
No.
Very different
some
today.
Some of the senses, I also share Kurt's sense that there was a prohibition on publishing amongst a fairly significant population amongst the poets. It was that publication lacked the immediacy of performance or something. And
that was the one thing that people wanted to prove. They wanted to prove a primacy of performance over print. And this was coming from the top right on down, and it was very difficult. There's an anecdote. I'm probably putting myself at peril for citing it in a certain way. But there's an anecdote I heard about Mark Smith going to a club, and he was conscious that other people were, not me, other people were running cameras on him, and he deliberately had the lights turned down because he didn't want the he wanted the audience to have the experience.
Yeah, but I'm say that Debbie, though, who really introduced me to the scene when I met her, she was already into the writing.
Yeah.
I never
we
got
didn't
this
all
thing.
Have that in
yeah,
this.
I never yeah. got this thing that you couldn't write. Yeah. In fact, she, right away she was like, yeah. and I showed her when I did my first book of poetry. I showed it to her.
Mm-hmm.
She was, and she helped me, you know, put things in order. It was a beautiful thing. She was a mentoring me
sure.
into that world. I never felt that.
That's
now,
a
it
good
might have been. Now, it might have been that when theater teacher was happening, there was people probably complaining and, you know, that's them. But then some of those people came back to me with mm-hmm. manuscripts. So I don't really see it as a very deep thing. Eventually, they are, not all of them, most of them decided, I want to get published.
We have a hung jury on the panel this particular point, it seems.
I think the dividing point kind of is the slam, because before the slam, I don't even want to call it the slam, let's just say the dividing point is maybe Mark. Let's just say that. Like, before, and I'm blaming Mark, you know, I'm just saying that, like, before that came along, I think there's like an age difference. I mean, I'm 51. You know, I graduated from Columbia in 83, and there was a lot of publishing going on then. And then when the slam came in, there was this thing where the page doesn't matter anymore. It's more what you bring to the arena, you know. So I'm thinking that there was kind of like a sea change maybe around, you know. And then, of course, Carl and I left for like a year. We were gone from 85 to 86, and when we came back, like, everything had exploded. So I think around 84, 85, that was the change.
What you're talking about is the development of a kind of dogma.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
And it wasn't the last, mm-hmm. and it wasn't the first. I distinctly remember performing at Name Gallery and being all but cornered afterwards by a few people from Randolph Street Gallery who had the did me the kindness of informing me that I was doing performance art wrong.
Yes, isn't that right?
Yeah. In a variety of ways. Yeah, yeah. And I had always thought that the great thing about something like performance art was that there wasn't a list of rules and regs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was performing as a couple of different characters at different points.
Because every mistake could be a new style.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the same dualism of you know, print over performance or performance over print. I've never really gotten that competitive impulse to divide in order to be on the better side of things.
And to me, a lot of slams today feel like, because the rules are so encumbering, or so right. there is like the overburden of regulation.
Right.
I wouldn't call it a lack of concern of creativity, but the obsessive concern for containing it.
And then you wonder why everyone sounds pretty much the same.
Makes the thing feel like a professional NFL football game more than it does a literary expedition or something.
Right. You only had one foot in bounds there.
Yeah. Folks are comparing seconds and arguing about this stuff. It's like it's a poem. Everybody, and this gets to another dichotomy
of the points are not the point. When it got that way, I'm out of it.
That was kind of where I backed down myself. Yeah. That when people were saying the points are not the point is the poetry, I was like, too late now, I'm out of here.
Actually, it's kind of affirming in a way. When you've got people from the elite telling you you're doing it wrong, I always wore that as a badge of honor.
Right. That's a total Chicago attitude.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's fun, too.
Yes, it is.
Speaking of Chicago attitude, this poetry slam and some of the spoken word accomplishments of people in Chicago during the 80s and 90s gradually became copied elsewhere. Sharon earlier mentioned the Cafe New Eureka, which had
really
a slam that was modeled on
the
Chicagotown Poetry Slam.
Sure.
You know,
the Bowery Poetry Club, it's coming out of
it's all out of the Chicago experience. And I always kind of found this ironic because based on some of the things that we've said here today, and one observation I wanted to add to the previous point about there seemed to be a resistance to professionalism here, to writing, publishing, teaching, consulting, whatever, as a professional pursuit. And what I found ironic was that these other cities would adopt this style of performance or presentation of poetry, which in many respects was like amateur hour.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments about that?
Well, again, it goes back to when you're an amateur, you don't know, you don't care about this stuff, so you can make all these mistakes that eventually become style. Mm-hmm. Eventually, that's one good thing about Chicago. You weren't being overwhelmed by the industry, whether it was big theater, big movies, whatever it was.
Or getting a job.
Yeah.
Doing
so
something,
people were just doing it. And then
which
I think they fell into some great, beautiful, artistic places. Not everybody was. I remember going to some of these bars and, you know, a lot of poets weren't really that hot, you know.
Right.
But you were waiting for that moment. You know, but you waited for that moment when somebody like Patricia Smith would come and then she'd read and she'd knock you down. That's what you were waiting for. Mm-hmm. I would just, you know, get drunk until somebody just woke me up. And then that made it worthwhile because how many people, how many places would that happen?
Keep in mind that the root of the word amateur is love.
Love.
For the love of it.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Every artist, poet, performer, professional or not, should be an amateur in that sense. Should be doing this primarily for the love of it.
And people should not be, people are really now, and maybe myself too, although I can't stop myself from doing it, I seem to do it all the time, people are afraid of making mistakes.
Yeah.
And I always have this thing in mind, this story that I heard when Dom Perignon was making champagne. He wasn't making champagne, he was making wine. And he made a mistake. And his monk drank some of this, and it was supposed to be wine, but it wasn't because a mistake had been made.
It was fizzy.
It was fizzy, and he called Dom Perignon over, and he said, "Come here, taste this. It's like you're drinking stars." And I always thought that was such a cool thing. That was champagne was a mistake.
That's awesome. Yeah,
it was a mistake.
Yeah. And we made mistakes. We, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we didn't pre-test stuff before taking it to the Green Mill or any of these other venues. We didn't do audience testing. We didn't do focus groups.
It was
just
we didn't do rehearsal.
Exactly. It was just, let me try this.
Yeah. But this is why it overwhelmed the country. I think the whole country became like Chicago. Now again, they didn't do it exactly like Chicago. No. They maybe got only the veneer of it. They didn't quite get it. But pretty soon, I'm telling you, I went to cities all over the country and other parts of the world, and they're doing Chicago stuff.
Yeah, I know.
We began to overwhelm whatever the poetry performance scene used to be. It became Chicago style, whether they called it or not.
It always pissed me off.
What did we learn by doing it in this immediate DIY way? You could tell really quickly whether a joke was working, whether a line was working, whether a piece was working, and then you take it back and, you know, you revise it.
Assuming people would talk with you, but often they did that.
Just facial expressions.
Often they did.
Expressions. You were that close.
You could tell by the audience reaction.
Yeah. You were that close.
You know.
Yeah.
There was a communication between the mic and the audience.
Mm-hmm.
That because very often the folks who were in the audience ended up on the mic. You know,
you
sort of camaraderie, like, oh yeah, well, I screwed up, didn't I? Yeah, and here's why, quietly. But it was immediate and constructive criticism, and I think that helped elevate things very quickly at the beginning.
Very quickly.
But it also
the audience was our focus group, basically.
Yeah, in a way, it also caught into another mechanism, which is like, how did I look? You know, it's a different, and you guys can talk about when you came in and how it was. I saw that it wasn't exactly narcissistic, but that sort of vanity element find its way into the movement over time, and it distressed me.
Yeah.
Well,
that's when you cut off your own permission to make mistakes.
But here's the thing about the Chicago poetry scene. Because we were amateurs, big egos tend to be overinflated.
Yeah.
I have to say that was part of it. I had a big ego. Everybody did. But on the other hand, I think you learn.
Yeah.
You learned, okay, that just helps you break through. Then you realize, don't have such a big ego. Knock yourself back down to the world. You know, and the audience would do that, and people would do that. The interesting thing about reading in a bar is when people stop drinking and they're paying attention. But you know what? If they're drinking and you're reading and they're still drinking, hey, you ain't getting over. You just know. Nobody has to tell you that. You know, it knocks your ego down eventually because then the real world comes and tells you, hey, you're really not that good.
Well, that's funny. Well, we have a few minutes left here. I want to ask maybe one more question and get a little more debate here, and then we'll open it up to a few questions from the audience. I hope we have enough time, you know, with the thousand of people lined up over here in the corner.
Tim, we had 7 out there at one point, for the record. Okay? So.
Let me talk a little bit now about the present day. I think all of us benefited immensely from our experiences. in various ways, publishing books, becoming more relevant or known to people, or communicating with the broad audience, and, you know, like Luis's case, he's a best-selling writer, and, you know, he came from here, and, like, he was one of us at one time, and just, you know, it's been great, and, you know.
Thanks for still associating with us.
That said, I have to say, and this is something I'm going to start with Paul about, because Paul and I had spent some time in recent years doing reading tours together. Their last couple of books came out roughly at the same time in 2008 and 2011 or 12. Or
11, yeah.
And we did some readings in other cities. We did some here in Chicago. And we were disappointed to find that there just wasn't that interest in live performance anymore in these places we were going. We used to, like, go to some places. Sometimes we went to the same places. For example, there was this bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin. When I read there in 1997, when my first book came out, I had 30, 40 people in the audience. We went there in 2008, and I think there were about 4 people in the audience.
A-balls, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're finding this in more and more places we go, and I'm almost wondering, has the performance instinct, the impulse, has it sort of faded in some ways? I mean, I know, Luis, you're very in demand as a speaker, but some of us other writers who, you know, we struggle and go to these places, and we there's two of, like, Paul and I, for example, and there's one person in the audience. You know, I mean, literally, there's, you know, more readers than writers, or more readers than audience members. So
now you're talking about the worst places on our tour, because there were other places on our tours that were just fine. But the trend has been down from over the years.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to blame it on the internet. I just am. I think people are staying home too much. I think they're favoring. Well, I can do that on my own. I can do that at home. It's harder and harder to get people out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want my life to become increasingly a series of screens. And I honestly don't think any of us at the end of, you know, on our deathbeds, no one here is going to be wringing our hands and saying, God, if I'd spent a little more time online, life would have been worthwhile.
No, I have to add that I think my audiences get to be pretty big. But I think it's because now I got books, not really because of the performance or Chicago scene, even though I'm always emphasizing it. I think it's because the books, I get pretty good audiences. But I also, what I did with the Chucha Centro is I'm in a community that is very culturally barren. And like I said,
you say barren?
Barren. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing there. 500,000 people. You have to understand, that's a lot of people. And there was no bookstores, no art galleries, no cultural centers, nothing there until I opened the Achuchas. Like I said, I brought Chicago to this place. And what's happening now is that every Friday night we have the only open mic, and 30 to 100 people show up. So there is, it's kind of like the Chicago thing. There's interest when it's coming from up, from the bottom up. But when you go to these universities, yeah, it is smaller. When you go to they're not into that. That's not, now they're into the book. That's why people come, because they got books. I'm not seeing the performance thing going on at that level. But I am seeing it in the community level coming up. Just open mic once a week, people show up.
Well, people find roles for that, you know. And each generation, I think, has to own its process in its own way. Paul, you were complaining about, I don't want to see myself as, in my case, as a web publisher and a guy who's been involved with electronic literature since God knows when, more screens are fine, but okay. What I fear is I don't want to have my work evolve entirely around presenting fossil media. Mm-hmm. I would like to see new people doing new things. I would like to see younger generations trying performance and other things. It's not like they have to try performance. I don't want to be hegemonic. I want to see people try what their passions direct them to do with their art. We all had been craving a chance to get our work in the air when we were all young people. Mm-hmm. And we did it. And I think we came out with many different things at once, not just Slam, which sort of assumed a primacy among us, but or even outside us, but different things that I think may come back in their own way historically as the literature evolves. But I'm not too wound up about it because I look at it as something generational. Talk to Kevin Koval, when I talk to Robbie Q. Telfer, and I've worked with both those guys, I hear one story about what slam should be. When I talk to their kids, are saying, well, yeah, I love Louder Than Obama. I love slamming. But you know what I really want to do is start books. And so I hear this. I hear a different story. I don't feel like I want to possess a generation younger than me with my dream. I want to let that generation do what it wants to do. It may be that that the younger people, wish we had a few more in this room, it may be that the younger people have their own muse and they just want to express it, and it doesn't happen to be ours, you know, and they're going to find a way to do it. So I have faith things will work out.
Well, I don't mean to decry all screens all the time, and in fact, you and I have worked, Kurt, on...
We got to American Film Institute doing our screens, you know, so we're not
stuff intended for a screen, but the high point for me was when our piece was on the screen at Cabaret Metro. Surrounded by people. Surrounded by people, and that's my point. Whatever direction it goes, and I just hope it's not individual people in their individual domiciles doing things electronically and virtually. I hope that we can retain that live performance shared space aspect.
Yeah.
You know, that's what made it exciting.
The other thing is when I hear people talk like this, like I'm sorry, but I am actually very pro-technology. I mean, if anybody knows me, you'll be surprised to find this, but I teach online and I do other things. But whenever I hear this thing like something's going away, it's being replaced by something I don't like, or not that I don't like, I don't agree with it. I think that the crisis in literature has already happened. It happened It happened in 7,000 BCE. And do you know what happened in 7,000 BCE?
The first lamp poet? No.
It was writing. When people learned that they could write things down and they didn't have to remember things and there wasn't a storyteller, the community didn't have a storyteller, there were no epics anymore. When things could be written down and not performed, that was the crisis in literature. And I swear to God, that is what we have never recovered from. And every time there's a new thing, every time it's like, oh, now, you know, we're not going to have books anymore, we're going to have iPads, people get freaked out. But, I mean, imagine what the storytellers of ancient Greece were thinking when people began to write things down. And where did writing come from? Writing came from trying to figure out how many units of wheat were sold off the Nile at, a certain time period so that people could get paid. I mean, writing was invented to record money transactions. And then all of a sudden somebody thought, oh, man, we could be writing shit down, you know. And that was the crisis.
Well, I'm not freaked out about the next best thing, next big thing, because it's the next big thing. I just want to go back to the last point I made. I don't want to get away from shared space.
Right.
But
I guess what he's saying, at a certain point, Homer, who had thousands of people, at a certain point had like four or five people show up at his last event.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Well, yeah. He did better after
company.
He died, actually.
Yeah.
His reputation really took off.
Because they got written up. That's the problem.
I just think that it's an interesting, I'm not like saying that you were wrong. I'm just saying that people, you know, talk about these, we're definitely in a transitional moment now. There's no way we can remember what the transitional moment was when storytelling became story writing. You know, I mean, that's a big deal. I think that's a big deal. I would like, you know, to write about it and know more about it myself, you know, when that transition was made. But it's very difficult because it was 7,000 BCE when it happened.
We talked about the interesting paradox to that, which is that, you know, there was this anti-writing
field. Yes.
And it was about getting off book and being able to go out there and do it without a script.
There you go.
So like in 7,000 BC, the storytellers were the authentic people. They're analogous to the slam poets from 1980.
See, it's history repeating itself.
The writers, the people who started writing it down, were inferior.
The young whippersnappers.
If you could look at it the other way, maybe the people writing it down were more advanced because they realized they didn't
have
to
talk.
Yeah, they had a technology. And it helped them out.
It was really advantageous to get off tablet.
And guess what? Now we're back on tablet.
Unfortunately.
How many?
Just no chisel. On the panel here, thanks so much for coming to Chicago. For those of us who came here from elsewhere, thanks so much for the Chicago people for hosting us. I want to open it up the last couple minutes here for questions.
He had his hand up the whole damn time.
I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you all for
thank you.
I just want to let you know, I was very much a part of your scene, and both pre-Mark and after Mark. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say this. A few of the notes that I had. First of all, about the academics versus the blue collars. Mm. I remember distinctly, I think it was at Club Dreamers, where there was a showdown between Mark Smith and a guy by the name of Chet Long.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And Chet Long was the academic.
Yeah. I remember that.
I remember distinctly there were two very specific camps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on, you know, which bars you read at or where, what side you came from, you know, I remember that it was... It was kind of tense.
Yeah.
I don't remember that at all, but I'm going to jump all over. The DIY. That's exactly what my friends and I did back in 1983. And I remember reading at Barbara's Bookstore.
Yeah.
I remember reading at the Get Me High Lounge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the beauty, and Luis, you kind of, actually, I think you and I had read at some point together,
so.
I think.
Yeah.
Is that the beauty is that the Get Me High from, my God, I was 17 years old then, is that it was an old man bar, and there were drunks, and there were people who didn't belong in this neighborhood.
It was real.
It was real.
Yeah.
And you came in there with a sense of, I can say anything here, and it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and you just started to do it. And you're right, there was no industry. There were no critics. You just did it because you wanted to do it. It was a Sunday night. Nothing else going on. If anything else, I could just sit here and have a beer.
And listen to Mary Shen Barnage.
Right. Oh, yeah. My God.
But the beauty was, if nothing else, I could still have a beer. It's entertaining, and it's okay. And then on top of it wasn't the slam part. It was open mic. Yeah. Everything was accepted, and you were okay. And we knew who was great, and we knew who really sucked.
Yeah.
But it was okay. Because we all kind of, you know, we're a fan.
That was important. It was
you know,
okay.
After a while, there were critics. After a while, The Reader was there, or Perform Inc. was there. And that did change the feel of it and gave rise to what I would call the development of the Randolph Street Gallery dogma phenomenon.
So like around 1986, I went to theater school, and I dropped out of the scene altogether. And then I came back because some very good friends of mine, Christopher Stewart, Karish.
Karish Ali-Lansa.
That's right. So this is actually, no, this is 1993.
Okay, so he would have been using the old name then.
So So it was around that time that the competition for the Poem for Warsaw was happening.
Yeah,
right.
And there was an organization called Neutral Turf.
I was one of the organizers.
Right. I happened to win that competition, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And went to Warsaw, and it was a big, nice to-do. But I remember Mark Smith was hosting a lot of these comments or a lot of these contests. And I remember distinctly just having him, you know, out of the side of my eyes that I wasn't slamming. I was just reading.
Yeah.
And he seemed a little disappointed in a lot of the people who were in this competition who weren't slamming. And at that point, that's kind of where I got off. I was not a slammer either. I just came to read my stuff and see what kind of...
But it wasn't supposed to be a slam thing. And I remember because I had battles with Mark Smith, who's a good friend of mine, but we would argue about this stuff because we even had issues with the language poets.
Oh, yeah.
And should they be involved? And eventually we said, why not? And everybody should be involved. Mm-hmm.
So after I got back from Warsaw, I saw it was Snake in the Heart opening.
Yeah.
And saw Marvin Tate and those guys. Christopher Stewart and their whole music thing, and it was something completely different than what I had left behind in the 80s. And I think one of the reasons why is it's become less democratic. Mm-hmm. It's because there's a lot more expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, look, I just want to go down to my watering hole I mean, virtually, I got off my typewriter and my laptop half an hour ago. I want to throw it out and see what sticks and what doesn't. And I think that's the element.
That world is gone.
It has lost itself. And we talk about it, especially...
It'll come back as something a little
Chicago
bit different.
And DIY. I mean, this is how the Steppenwolf started. I mean, we have a whole a second city. Right. We have a history of doing it ourselves if
city
we don't
of big
like
shoulders.
It anybody else.
Yep.
Sure. Actually, people do it like in New York. Like I think about Ugly Duckling Press. That was totally DIY, and now it's beautiful letterpress books, hardcover books. There's always room for DIY. There's got to be, you know.
It's very interesting that you're saying that. First of all, I just want to say to you guys, you were marvelous. I've been to a bunch of panels this weekend, past couple days. No wit. You guys definitely prove that
okay,
Chicago writers are the funniest writers.
God damn right.
Did she say we had a sense of humor?
Bless your soul.
And actually the whole reaction to our small audience and the way you kind of process that, there's something to that, something to think about after the panel. But that's for another
time. Well, that's because we're so used to it. You mentioned Barbara's Bookstore. Yeah. I read at Barbara's Bookstore multiple times. When I called them, like, last year to line up a reading to, like, promote this book that came out, I never received a phone call back.
Fuck them.
No kidding.
Yeah. Fuck them.
And that's not an isolated incident.
That is
the rule.
A huge and important conference, which you may already know, or you may not give a damn, at the University of Maine, Orono, the Poetry of the 80s, coming up. The deadline's in, like, 2 weeks.
Really?
I think you have a beautiful thing here.
We should do it.
Do it. Yeah. Tim, bring us over.
We should do it.
The class.
Just take it on the road.
I love Maine.
Those dynamics.
We should do it.
Same.
We're thinking like same panel, different. Yeah.
Totally.
Okay. Yeah. And maybe we could each do a little quick reading.
There you go.
As part of it.
Do you, if you have the information, will you email it to him and then he can, or to me and then I'll
email
it to him.
Yeah. That's what I mean. They have a website. They give all the requirements.
We're taking on the road, Tim.
Is that a Steve Evans?
Yeah,
Steve Evans
doing
that
in the 80s for the poetry project? I'm hoping to moderate a panel, so I'm getting. Gathering information, and I really started thinking about, among other aspects of the 80s, exactly as the do-it-yourself miniature, and I didn't have
One of the things that didn't go, like, remarked very much during this event was that I was a zine publisher during this time. I mean, I was one of these pioneering, stapling together, like, stuff that I Xeroxed, and that's how Tomorrow Magazine started. Eventually it grew and got more of a national audience, and I got national poets sending me stuff, which was nice because the local poets were not sending me stuff.
Some of
and
us were.
There was a whole simultaneous.
I sent you stuff.
Yeah, we sent you stuff.
I sent you stuff.
Everybody sent me stuff.
I didn't even send you poetry. I think I sent you Apple graphics or something.
Yeah,
they gave you a cover photo, too.
You know who we're forgetting about? And I can't believe. We're forgetting about Richard Huddle and the Chicago Poetry Newsletter because he was like, he was doing that in like 1980.
Yeah. The simultaneous to this do it yourself
you
poetry
Richard?
Scene, there was this do it yourself zine scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many people doing
poetry
scenes. And they
were in parallel.
That's true.
Yeah, and there were movements. In fact, there were other pockets of poetry excellence going on at the time as well, in Cleveland, in L.A., San Francisco, New York, Boston. So the DIY thing is very important, and I'm really glad that people dwelt on it. Yeah, I think...
Well, it started in the 70s, because the whole punk scene was 70s.
Yeah, the whole, like, get a great outfit at Salvation Army,
For $3.
For $3, and then, do these magazines. I mean, there was something, it was just...
Start your own band. We started a band this week. We're playing next Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. A club could be in somebody's house.
Yeah.
Like, how many times you probably, we did readings. Somebody would just, like, clear it. Oh, I'm thinking of? Sandra Cisneros' brother, Henrique, had Galleria Kike on Harrison Street.
True.
Yeah, and it was just his house. He had like a loft with a big window, and he would just clear it out, and we would all read there.
That's right.
Yeah. Whatever happened to him?
Any other questions before we wind things up? We're a little after our time. Yeah.
Is there somewhere where there are actual physical copies of some of these magazines you're talking about from the era of the zines that were published during the time? Hmm.
In my plastic bin back in Brooklyn. All the old B-Cities and Letter
We actually got tons of boxes. I have 160 boxes. I saved everything.
Me too.
Of the zines, of the Letter X.
I've been doing the same, but I try to scan. In 94, when I started putting the website out, I started scanning them. But I only got a few of them online. But I I listening to everybody else here, I want to keep doing that much more aggressively now. I think that the,
if
it's not just publications, it's tapes, it's media that has gone obsolete. I went nuts with a friend a couple of years couple weeks ago.
What about the Chicago Underground Library?
Yeah. Yes, they have some Tomorrow magazines, I know. Actually, another resource that you could check out is something I had a hand in putting together in the mid-90s at DePaul University, the Mary Kuntz Archive.
K-U-N-T-Z.
Yeah, K-U-N-T-Z.
That's Kuntz.
I could make a poem out of that.
Yeah, that's
part of the Mary Kuntz Archive.
They collected a number of zines, particularly the first year of the conference.
Aunt Pussy, right?
They did a lot of poetry zines that were published at that time in the late 80s, early 90s. Tomorrow magazine is collected by a number of rare book archives like the New York Public Library, Brown University, DePaul. A few other places.
And you should come pick this up because we still have the Atucha Press books from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so come pick them up so you can have your own copies of them.
The Letter X archive was completely lost by its last editor. Yeah, C.J. Lady. No, C.J. Lady took it over after Barry, and then he lost it.
Also worth checking out are more contemporary books by people who were a part of that scene.
Yeah, like this one, for example.
These.
Or some of Louise's.
That's right.
I just have one comment to this gentleman who was saying about all the different things that he did and so forth. I did a reading in my very early career at No Exit Cafe up in Rogers Park. Mm-hmm. It was a similar audience like this, and half of them were sitting around talking, drinking coffee. And I obligatorily do the reading. I think it was with Chris Goralka and, who's the guy who took over after Mark? He did a book called Jet Plane.
Not Ron Gillette.
That Glazner.
Not Gary Glazner. No, he's here in Chicago.
Tim
I'll think
Anderson.
Of it. Tim An- no, not Tim.
He did a plane.
Yeah,
he did
Tim
a book
Anderson.
Jet Planes.
Tim Anderson. He Chris Goralka and I, were, I think, the featured artists. We're doing this stuff, and we're doing and doing and doing. And like here, like three or four people are present, and the rest are doing something else. I go down the street in DePaul, and an old guy walks up to me and says, "Hey, aren't you that poet?" I'm like, "Where did you get that idea?" "I saw your reading." I'm like, "Where was that?" "No Exit." I said, "Who are you?" "I was the guy playing speed chess." So you don't know where your audience lives when you do these things. Sometimes I think we forget that today, that we're so busy being fabulous or worried about what the big-time people are doing, we forget we have... It's really just an act of connecting.
Yep.
It's just being present for somebody else to say something.
Community that Louise mentioned.
Exactly.
And I have to add that one of the components that we did, what a lot of people don't talk about, is we went into the schools, the prisons, juvenile halls. I went to the Audi home, the largest juvenile lockup in the world, used to be here in Chicago. And I would go to the prison. We would take slam, we would take poetry, we would take writing, and we got whole new audiences. I did all the homeless shelters for the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. Mm-hmm. I was going around for years, going to all these homeless shelters with no money. Mm-hmm. I wasn't getting paid to do, and we published chapbooks of writings from these homeless people. Mm-hmm. So we were doing things that very few people were willing to do. And then not everybody in the scene wanted to do that part, but some of us were there. I had Sin Salash go with me to the homeless shelters of all people. She was in there right there with him.
Mm-hmm.
She
was popular.
Yeah.
Wow.
All righty. Well, it's almost 6 o'clock.
Oh, jeez.
Any final questions?
Oh, jeez.
Tim, can we just go
now
down
you know
the
you're
line
in Chicago when Tim goes, oh, jeez.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Paul,
30 seconds or less.
Final remarks. Yeah, brief.
Last request.
Final remarks. Luis, go.
Final remarks? Well, anyway, thank you all. My feeling is that what everybody's saying about the changes is really important. I think some of us have been able to ride those changes. Some of us have been fighting it, but you can't fight it. The idea is to keep making art and keep doing it yourself and keep making mistakes. That's where art is created.
Mm-hmm. And I think don't be afraid to look back at what was already done in order to come up with something new. Because sometimes the newest things are from the oldest ideas.
Paul, why don't I move to you?
Sure.
I'm not sure I have anything off the top of my head.
But. You know, one of the words that comes to mind when I think back of those days is gratitude. I am so grateful that that scene existed.
Me too.
That it had a place for me. It made me a better writer, a better performer. It made me a better educator in my kind of more recent career over the last 15 years as a teacher as well. And I thought about this a lot when my most recent book came out last year, because there's a section in it. It's a 50-story collection. There's a whole section called Stage to Page, where I went back to the stuff that I developed as a performance artist and spoken word artist during those years and kind of refined it as written work for the first time and kind of fell in love with the scene all over again, with the objective distance of time and not remembering quite as clearly all the gripes I had with it. You know, there's nothing like time and distance to make you focus on the things you loved. And I'm just grateful for the scene, for the people who showed up to listen then, and grateful that people showed up to listen to us today as well.
And it was fun.
It was great.
It was
fun.
Great fun.
Kurt?
I have my own gratitude, which we don't have time to cover. So I'll just say a couple of things. Honor your muse. It's mythical, but I love the idea. And don't be afraid to be literate, regardless of what that means, whether it's coming, whether it's the language is coming at you through a flat panel LCD, through a radio station, through a podcast, through a book, through a chapbook, through a zine. Read your media, understand it, and you come out stronger. Let it talk to you. You might disagree, but that disagreement is a dialogue that can educate you right there.
Read
follow
our books, because now we all got books. Read our
books. Yeah, that's a good thing.
The one thing, the only takeaway I guess I could offer, because everybody's been so eloquent here, is I found the experience very empowering.
Mm-hmm.
I came out of graduate school. I washed out of an MFA program because I hated it. I hated the people. I hated the workshop environment. It was clinical at the University of Idaho.
Oh, well.
Well, it was actually a pretty decent program. I just didn't like the. I didn't like grad school. And it just seemed like the experience of literature was so circumscribed.
He was born in a trunk in the Princess Theater.
When I came here, people were taking charge and of their literature and presenting it without anybody's permission.
Right.
And that was an extremely empowering thing. And it opened my eyes to so many other things in the world as far as literature goes. It broadened my perspective. And, you know, I really kind of miss it in some ways. Living in New York, there's not that similar energy.
We'll take you back anytime.
There's also a glass ceiling where, you know, if you're not a Harvard product, you're basically shit out of luck succeeding in literature. That sucks. That kind of attitude sucks. And it was never that way here.
Almost the reverse, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And thanks to Tim for conceiving of us and organizing this panel.
Thank you, Tim.
I think he thought that we were going to be battling and fighting.
This conversation was recorded with the written consent of all guest speakers. This program was produced by yours truly and recorded before a live audience at the Palmer House Hilton Hotel. Music by Footage Firm. I'm Kurt Heinz.